Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and SiriusXM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We are now 10 days into the Trump administration's 15-day Slow the Spread initiative, combating the coronavirus epidemic in the United States, a pandemic, of course, infecting the entire globe. But what's the truth about it? And what are the myths about COVID-19? And how can you best use the right information? Well, join me to talk about this and to separate fact from fiction is Dr. Lisa Fitzpatrick. She is a CDC-trained epidemiologist, a board-certified infectious disease physician, and founder and CEO of Grapevine Health Medical Center. Lines are open if you have a comment or a question about any of the information that you are getting, wherever you are getting it. If you have any comments or you're worried about some of the stuff you're hearing, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Dr. Fitzpatrick, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Hello, Harold. Great to be here.
Before I even get in, indeed it has been, and before I even get into that, I want to ask you, because this has really been kind of the way that all of us journalists have been talking to some of the people who have been supplying us with this information. How are you doing as you're dealing with the social distancing and this new normal? How are you handling it?
I appreciate you asking. It hasn't been too challenging for me because I have a balance of being with people and practicing social distancing. I think for people who are strongly extroverted, it's difficult, but I'm half extrovert, half introvert, so I'm okay.
Okay.
I appreciate you asking though, because a lot of people are not okay. It's hard to be isolated.
Indeed it is. And I want to get to some of the information because you've been spending quite a bit of time, fighting misinformation, particularly as it comes through social media. Talk to me about some of the things that you've heard that are just incorrect, just horribly incorrect and really causing some concern for you.
Sure. The first one is that coronavirus only affects certain races, and specifically that it does not affect black people. And I heard this several times before Idris Elba announced that he tested positive for the virus. But even beyond that, people are wondering why we're not seeing coronavirus infections in as many black people. And I think the point here is that, viruses don't discriminate by race. Just as colds and flu attack people from all races all across the globe, this virus is no different. The second concerning piece of misinformation is about a home remedy that involves drinking bleach.
Mm.
And this is concerning because bleach is toxic if ingested internally. So I think what's happened is There's a lot of information out about how you can disinfect surfaces and what you can use, and bleach is one of those products that you can use as an antiseptic or to clean surfaces. But I think people have been taking that a bit too far, and maybe they're diluting it with water. I don't think anyone is drinking straight from the bottle, but I think people have tried to add a teaspoon, here or there in an effort to combat the virus.
Mm.
And then finally, this isn't necessarily misinformation, but there's a lot of confusion about who needs to be tested. There seems to be confusion about should you wait until you have symptoms? If you have symptoms, should you be tested or not? And the challenge in explaining this in a most simplistic way is because ideally everyone should be tested. Everyone who wants to know if they have the virus, or definitely everyone who has symptoms, should be tested in a perfect world. But we're not in a perfect world right now because we were so far behind when we really took strong public health action, that the virus had already spread pretty widely across the United States. So those are the biggest three areas where we're getting a lot of confusion and or misinformation.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are trying to bust the myths about the COVID-19 virus. If you have any questions about it, about anything that you've heard, particularly things that are coming to you through social media that you have questions about so-called cures and treatments and the like, as well as some of the medical conspiracy theories that actually are really, really harmful to individuals and our community at large, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let us talk a little bit about social distancing. We've seen, or we've been told, I should say, 6 feet is the distance that we should stand from each other to help stem the tide of infection. Why 6 feet? And how is the coronavirus transmitted from person to person?
And thank you for asking that, because that's also a very common question. Primarily, it's transmitted through respiratory droplets. So let's say you and I are sitting next to each other on the metro, and you sneeze or a cough surprises you, and you don't get an opportunity to completely cover your cough. You can transmit, or you might have some respiratory droplets coming from your cough or from your sneeze, and it gets on me, and I inhale that while we're sitting next to each other on the metro. The reason for the distance is because we do know that when that situation occurs with you sneezing or coughing and not properly covering your cough or sneeze, the virus or the germs can travel a certain distance. And so 6 feet is considered the distance at which is safe. I would be safe from your cough or your sneeze.
A lot of people are concerned about touch and how long the virus lasts on skin, hard surfaces, plastic, or even in the air. What can you tell us about that? Can you set the record straight on that?
The general rule of thumb is that the virus can live on surfaces for a few hours. There have been studies that have shown that on cardboard it may be able to thrive even as long as a day or more. But I think the way we protect ourselves from surfaces is by washing our hands. And this is, I know, so simplistic, and people think, well, that's not that big a deal. Even though this is transmitted by respiratory droplet, those droplets can get on surfaces and devices that we touch. And so regardless of how long they live, we have the tools, we have the power to reduce the spread by washing our hands. It's very difficult not to touch your face. It's a very human instinct to touch your face. It's something we don't think about. But now is the time, I think, many of us are getting in the habit of being mindful about not touching our faces. Because what happens is, if I'm sitting next to you on the metro, you sneeze, some of the germs get on my phone, I touch my phone, and the next thing I know, I touch my face. That is a very, that's a perfect situation in which I can infect myself because I've been so close to you.
202. Oh, go ahead. Please finish your point.
I just wanted to say, it's not an oversimplification. It's a simple thing we can do, but it goes a long way to prevent the transmission of infection.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're separating fact from fiction as it relates to the coronavirus pandemic. What you need to know. I'm going to go to the phone lines. Let's talk to Desi. Desi calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, and I appreciate this conversation today. I have two concerns. My main concern is I'm concerned about there's not enough information being put out there about the millennials and our young people who are not taking this seriously. And I want to apologize if this was already covered. I just tuned in, moving from another room that had the radio on. my daughter traveled to California this morning, and I tried to stop her. She's 25, you know, what can I say? This young people are just, I mean, they've always been, you know, mentally invincible, but I don't think that there's not enough information coming out about directed to them directly. My other issue is I want to know what products we can use to, like, you know, sterilize doorknobs, light switches, you know, locks, you know, the different places in your house that could be transmitting the virus.
Okay. Thank you so much for your questions. Dr. Fitzpatrick, let's talk first about the millennials issue, young people as a whole, because there's been so much concern about young people who spend time spring breaking on Florida beaches and other places. Talk to me about the major issue regarding young people and the virus.
The challenge is when we first started talking about this pandemic, we focused a lot on who was dying from infection. And it's still true that the majority of people who are dying are elders, people who are over the age of 70. And even in Italy, it looked like the average age of people who died was 80 years old. So when we started the epidemic with that message to the community that this is a virus, you know, 85% of people will do fine with the virus, but those who have complications, end up in the hospital, and who end up dying from this condition are older. And so once that gets set in the mindset, it's very difficult to change it, because as the pandemic has evolved, we've started to see there are younger people who are also dying from the virus. The challenge with young people is, as the caller said, this syndrome of invincibility. I feel fine. There's, you know, nothing can harm me, or I'll get a little cold and then let's move on. But I think that what's important for them to realize is that they have the potential to affect what happens to our elders or people who have chronic health conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, people who have cancer. So if they are, because we know that some people, and it's a small percentage, people who don't have symptoms can transmit the virus. So let's say they're in close proximity, they're not social distancing, and they're close to someone who has diabetes, for instance. They can transmit the virus to that person, who will then have a bad outcome. So I think it's, she's right, we probably need to talk much more about this. And I know Dr. Birx, who's on the coronavirus task force, has tried to emphasize this, but we are very behind in the messaging with millennials, and we really need them to help us in this effort to protect the public's health.
Mm-hmm. And about the cleaning, I've got about a minute or so before the break. What is the best thing to use, whether you can buy it in the store or something you may have around the house, to clean countertops, doorknobs, light switches, and the like?
But, coronaviruses, these viruses have been around for a long time. This one behaves in a different way than most of them. But they're susceptible to the same cleaning products we've been using. So that's why we've suggested hand washing with soap, hand sanitizers, bleach, Lysol. One of the myths was that this is not a new virus because it's found on the Lysol can. So there was some misunderstanding about how can it be new when Lysol kills it. So you don't need to run out and buy new products. You probably already have the products that will kill this virus.
And what about the alcohol wipes, for example, the kinds that are in the cans? There's always been this question about percentage of alcohol content. And when we say alcohol content, I'm assuming we're talking about isopropyl alcohol, the same kind of stuff that you may put on a cut. Is that correct?
Basically, but, you know, alcohol is not always 100% effective. That's why we prefer using soap and water. That is really disinfecting when it comes to washing hands. But there are some other non-alcohol-based sanitizers out on the market, and they should also do fine. You know, the hand sanitizers that are used in health systems, some of them are alcohol-based, some of them are not. But in general, alcohol does a decent job, but I prefer soap, plain old soap and water.
Mm-hmm. And Lysol, Pine Sol, those kinds of things for cleaning just as you would any other time?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much for your phone call, Desi. Tina, calling from Baltimore. We're going to talk to you next. If you're still on the line at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're going to dispel the myths of the coronavirus pandemic. If you have a question, we're taking phone calls even after 7:30. So please give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you're having difficulty getting through, please keep trying. I promise we will get to you. And by the way, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment in its entirety via podcast on WHUR.com. The information is right there, so please stay with us. Angela Stribling is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. But this discussion continues on SiriusXM Channel 141 in just about 15 seconds. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're separating COVID-19 fact from fiction. My guest is Dr. Lisa Fitzpatrick. She is a CDC-trained epidemiologist, a board-certified infectious disease physician, and founder and CEO of Grapevine Health Medical Center. If you have a comment or a question about any of the information that you're getting, if you're confused about the COVID-19 pandemic and some of the information that you've been exposed to on the internet, for example, or on social media, please give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let me go to Tina calling from Baltimore. Tina, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I feel really honored to be on the air like this.
Well, thank you.
I'm just so frustrated, you know, just like we all are. Did anybody come to realize that maybe this could be a big scare for us, like a terrorist attack? I mean, it's going from the country to the states, hitting people left and right. I mean, somebody must have did something to somebody so they could cover it up with this epidemic that's going on right now. It's really terrible to have the business closes, having the people, you know, think about it. The summertime, we washed our hands. We cleaned up around the house. We didn't get none of these things where they're hurting us, killing us. You know what I mean?
It's just, well, let me see what Dr. Fitzpatrick has to say about that. Because, and this is the kind of thing, Dr. Fitzpatrick, that is concerning to a lot of people. When you have some of these kind of medical conspiracy theories and the like, can you try to at least address what she's saying?
Sure, yeah. I do hear this a lot. But again, viruses are so easily transmitted, and now you have to remember we live in a global society with international travel. You can get on the internet right now, book a flight, and be on a flight tonight to take you just about anywhere in the world. And I think this is why it was so easy for this virus to travel around the world. It flew around on airplanes, on people's devices, people sick and traveling anyway. So how we can so easily get to a situation like this. But the question you're asking is about how this all started. And I couldn't even begin to speculate or to say it came from one place or another. All we know is that it originated in Wuhan, China, and from there it spread. But to say any more than that about whether or not this was an act of terrorism or if it was deliberate, I certainly couldn't speculate on that. But the one thing I do know is that it's in our control to now arrest the spread of this virus. And we do that with the measures we've been talking about, like hand washing, being sure that you cover your cough and sneeze, staying home if you're sick, and then, of course, social distancing, which is not comfortable for most people. But it's really the only way we have now to stop the spread, because we were so late with getting tested. When these sorts of outbreaks happen, and they do happen, so you remember Ebola, you remember the SARS or MERS outbreaks that happened. These viruses travel from their initial place, the initial place where they're identified, they easily travel. So it's not the first time we're seeing this. It's the first time we're seeing something travel this quickly and efficiently, especially what we're seeing in New York and that we saw in the nursing home. But again, in both of those instances, part of the problem was that we were not ready to identify people who had the infection. Because the first step in the outbreak investigation is to find the cases. Who are the people that have it? And from there, you can fan out and find the people they've been in contact with. And if you stop it in its tracks in the beginning, you wouldn't see what we're seeing right now.
I see. Tina, thank you so much for your comment. Let me talk a little bit about what we've been hearing from the White House, because you did mention, for example, Ebola, SARS, bird flu. And, mm-hmm. of course, the president mentioned yesterday that businesses should start to open up again around Easter, that people in certain parts of the country where there are fewer infections, fewer confirmed infections, that the social distancing should be reduced. And we are only talking about just a few weeks, some 18 days before Easter now. Your thoughts about that. Do you think that that's the smart move?
Given where we are now, it doesn't seem realistic to me, mostly because we still have a crisis situation in New York City. Apparently the cases are still increasing there. And now New Orleans and Louisiana is on the radar for the same reason. And I think, again, because we were not prepared to identify people who had this virus early on, we didn't have the ability to test widely enough. That's how this thing got out of control. And so we don't know where else this, you know, another hot spot like Washington State or like New York might crop up. But it certainly looks like Louisiana. I've heard, you know, concerns about Georgia. So if states decide, and this is my understanding, even if the president wants to open up the country, quote unquote, I think the governors would have to really decide what happens. And if they do, I hope they first will take the step of case identification. So if it's true they don't have a lot of movement across the state or in and out of the state, and they have the ability to test widely across the state so that they know how prevalent the infection is in the state, then maybe they could consider that. But I just can't imagine a scenario in which 18 days from now we would have that much clarity about what this virus is doing, where it's going next, or that we have reduced the spread effectively enough to to open up to open everything up again. I can't imagine.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the coronavirus pandemic and busting the myths about this situation here, not only in the United States, but worldwide. Let me go back to the phone lines. Let's talk to Dr. Taylor calling from Maryland. Dr. Taylor, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. First of all, I enjoy your show, and thanks so much for having this information and Dr. Fitzpatrick on. I'm an ear, nose, and throat physician. I'm actually president of the ear, nose, and throat organization for the country. And one of the myths that seems to be very prevalent is that of the impact of ibuprofen or Advil or any of the non-steroidals on the virus and making it more virulent. I was just wondering if you could say something about that.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. That was an early myth that was floating around on social media, and it's been disproven. So people who have symptoms, if they're feeling achy, headaches, or if they're having fever, there's no problem taking ibuprofen. I mean, the person may have other reasons not to take ibuprofen in high doses. Maybe they have problems with their kidneys or other reasons their doctor or a healthcare provider have told them not to. But having coronavirus infection is not a problem. Related to this, I just want to the person who brought this to my attention also brought an issue to my attention that I think it bears some attention, particularly in the Black community and particularly among men. So we were talking about how the people who seem to die most often from this infection are elders, and she said, well, my friend's husband was only 52, and he died. So how do you explain that? Well, first of all, there are always outliers. But when I asked a follow-up question about the gentleman, I wanted to know, was he in good health? And she said, well, you know, I spoke to his wife, and she said that he didn't like doctors, and he actually hadn't had a physical in over 10 years.
Well, there you go.
Which means he could have been in a high-risk group, someone who had diabetes, someone who had undiagnosed heart disease or high blood pressure, and that is what made him higher risk for someone, getting the infection and then having a bad outcome. And it just reminded me that a lot of people in our community, whether it's distrust, denial, frustration with the healthcare system, not wanting to know or hear bad news, these are all the reasons we don't go to the doctor. This is a wake-up call for us to be proactive about our health and make sure we know what's normal for us so that if something happens, we can say to a healthcare provider, you know, this is not how my body normally reacts. There's something wrong. But if we're not paying attention, we can't point those things out to our healthcare providers.
I think that's such an excellent point. And thank you, Dr. Taylor, for sharing your thoughts with us. I want to talk a little bit about how what your best estimate may be for best and worst case scenarios. And the reason I ask this, because we did eventually see the bird flu go away, SARS, mm-hmm. and Ebola. But for this, as bad as it is, and let us be clear, there were lives lost with Ebola, bird flu, and SARS. This is no different when you're speaking, when you're generally speaking. Do you believe that perhaps, like many other coronaviruses, that this may go away when the weather gets warmer? Do you believe that the winter, not just here in the D.C. metro, but across the country, was just not as severe as it has been in years past, and whether or not that may have had an impact on it?
So anything I say here would be complete speculation, only because we've never seen this virus, and we can't predict what it's going to do. But viruses will shift over time. They may weaken. They may get a little bit stronger, become more easily transmitted. So any of these things can happen. But my hope is, and what I do believe, is that we will see a reduction in the transmission over time. But I think we're in such a crisis mode right now. It's hard to even speculate when that might be. Having schools be dismissed until the end of the school year, I don't know if that's necessary. But I certainly know that the precautions we're taking right now, since we were so behind on testing, is probably our best chance to end this quickly. And so everyone has to participate, including the millennials we talked about earlier, because it really is the only thing we have right now to slow the spread quickly. So what's happening in New York, what's happening in Washington State, we could see the case rates come down if people practice social distancing and cough and sneeze hygiene, washing their hands. We all have to be doing these things in order to see the spread come to slow as quickly as possible. Mm. I don't anticipate this will be going on into the fall, but the argument against warm weather is that these cases have been found in more tropical climates. I know they're seeing quite a bit of it in Australia, for instance, Singapore, other places that are warm. So I don't know that we should hang our hats on waiting for warm weather.
That's an interesting point. Let me go back to the phone lines. Tyrone calling from D.C. Tyrone, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, yes. I just wanted to express my opinion, what I think people should be doing more so than anything, instead of stacking up on food and things like that. I think we should go back to the earth as far as plant-based things like black seed oil, which Dr. C.B. Talked about in some of his sessions before he passed away, and ginger, beets, and celery, and garlic.
And what do you believe, Tyrone, would be the purpose of those foods as it relates to combating a virus?
Builds your immune system up.
I see. Well, let me see what Dr. Fitzpatrick has to say about that in using some of these, naturopathic items, yeah, for lack of a better term, to deal with one's immune system.
Yeah, this is a very common point of discussion as well. These things are really important when it comes to protecting yourself from acquiring an infection. So if your immune system is strong, your stress levels are low, you're in good health, you're able to more effectively fight off viruses. Now that we are in this situation, people who are already exposed and infected, people who are already sick, it's unlikely that those things would completely solve our problem. I think there is some impact from some of the interventions you're talking about, but I don't know that we can rely on those things in an epidemic situation, because people haven't been building up their immune system, as you said, all along, and they are vulnerable to contracting infections. So I always think it's a good idea to practice healthy eating and focusing on things that will build your immune system. But I think so many of us are too far behind to have any of those make much of a difference when you're sick already.
Mm-hmm. Tyrone, thank you so much for your phone call. One of the other things that I've also seen on social media, and I've seen it several times, I even saw it today, people were talking about treatments versus vaccines, where there was a man who was inhaling the steam or mist of garlic and lemon and some other stuff. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? I'm sure you've probably seen something similar on social media about that, Dr. Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, I have. You know, and the truth is, these are the kinds of things I would love to be able to study, because I can't endorse any of these things as a treatment for any kind of viral or bacterial infection unless I have the data to convince me that this worked. And so the challenge we have without the science behind it is wondering, well, what would have happened had you not taken the steam? So let's say five people do the steam and then five people don't do the steam, and then within 2 to 3 days, they're all basically at the same state of health. They're either better or they're the same or they're worse. It's hard to know if it was the steam that made them better. And so, again, I think anything that helps to improve, decrease stress, boost the immune system, and things that relax us will strengthen our immune system because they are reducing the stress hormones. So whether it's dancing or getting enough sleep, eating good food, being in community around people, all those things are really great immune system boosters. And so I think the choices around steam showers and eating certain kinds of foods that make us feel healthy, whole, and happy, I can't dismiss those as having an impact. But I wouldn't endorse those as the treatment for this virus.
Let me go back to the phone lines. Shanita, calling from Bowie. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I appreciate the insight segment. I wanted to say that first. I have a question for the doctor, and this kind of piggybacks on what the other caller said, and I do apologize for being redundant in some form or the other callers because I couldn't hear everything. Is there anything like colostrum that we can strengthen the immune system? Because I've heard studies.
Sorry, I'm not hearing the caller.
Okay, she's kind of breaking up. Did you say colostrum?
Yes, colostrum, yes. The colostrum that actually helps to create memory cells, which then create natural antibiotics in our body, which would then fight off this antigen, or, if you will, the coronavirus. Could colostrum possibly help us?
Help me with that, with the colostrum piece, Dr. Fitzpatrick. First of all, what is that? What is colostrum?
Well, generally, it's a protein that's made in the body, but I can't speak on this because I don't know. I mean, obviously, I don't know everything there is to know about viruses in the body. I know a lot because of my specialty, but I haven't seen any science or data on this, so I would be remiss in even offering any insight about it.
Colostrum, it isn't... Help me with that, because I am a father, and I seem to remember that term mentioned around the time of the birth of my daughter. Doesn't that have something to do with, and I may be wrong, with breastfeeding and...
that's pretty good. Yeah. So
it was 21 years ago, but I do remember that now. Yes.
You don't seem old enough to have a daughter or a son that old.
Thank you that much. It's a daughter. She's graduating from Howard in May. I'll send you a check for the compliment. But I do remember that now. That colostrum before a new mother. Expresses milk, that yes. Colostrum is the first thing that comes from the breast when the baby is first latching on. And I do remember that her doctor was saying, my daughter's doctor was saying, that these are the kinds of things that do help build up the defense for children.
Right, because the colostrum has, it has proteins. So if the mom has had infections before, and when the body sees a new germ, it starts to work, building antibodies to help fight against repeat infections. And so these antibodies are also in the colostrum or in the milk. But the, you know, the challenge with saying that this would be a treatment for coronavirus is because it's a new virus, and we don't know who has antibodies to them and if these antibodies would actually be protective again if someone came in contact with this strain of coronavirus. So that's why I'm not able to speak on it.
Shanita, thank you for taking me back to the birth of my daughter. And that was a very thought-provoking piece of information that you shared with us. So thank you so much. I do want to talk a little bit more about some of the things that we are seeing about masks. We've seen them in Southeast Asia. We see them now. What, if anything, do masks protect us or others from? Or is this just another thing that is just going to make us, that is psychological?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as you walk around, you see people, all sorts of folks with masks, and you don't know why they're wearing them. The idea behind the mask is that the mask, if you have the right kind of mask, you may have heard this term N95, it's the kind of mask that presses flush up against the face. Mostly healthcare workers wear these masks, and it's to protect them. But in general, for the public, we expect the people who wear masks will be people who actually have the infection, because These masks are helping to reduce the spread of the respiratory droplets. If you were to go out in public with a mask on and you don't have any infections and you are wearing it because you think it keeps you safe from inhaling the germs from someone who's infected, that's actually less likely, because the masks that you buy in the CVS or Walgreens, those masks, you know, they're open on the side. And there's still an opportunity for these aerosolized droplets to infect you. You know, people also are asking me how, you know, they're incredulous that CDC would suggest people use bandanas. We now know, someone asked about that. There is a study now that was quickly done to look at the impact of wearing bandanas. And they decided they're not as good because they retain too much moisture. But I think their thinking was that if you have something that wraps all the way around, that prevents the entry through the sides and over the top, that this might be a substitute. But I think, you know, people are really disappointed and discouraged by that suggestion.
One of the other things that I am particularly curious about, because early on, it was said that the symptoms are very similar to the flu. So how might the symptoms be different from the flu, if at all?
Another great question. So the flu symptoms are pretty typical. Flu symptoms, you might get a cough, but most people will have a fever and they will have profound body aches, very tired, so tired they may not be able to get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
But with coronavirus, the symptoms have been pretty consistently dry cough, a fever, and shortness of breath in people who progress to severe disease. So looking for a fever and a dry cough, those are the sign or the symptoms that should make one concerned that this might be coronavirus. And so the other condition that comes into play here, especially now that it's spring, is hay fever. And hay fever can cause a cough because it causes runny noses. And with a runny nose, you can get post-nasal drip. And post-nasal drip can lead to a cough. But I think with hay fever, most of the time, hay fever is not new onset. People will know they have a history of hay fever. This is my problem. I started coughing last week, and my nose was itching. My eyes were runny. I knew it wasn't COVID because it made sense that it was hay fever. So to distinguish between the flu, I think the biggest distinguishing feature is these muscle aches and profound body aches in flu, but you don't get the shortness of breath in flu like you do with coronavirus.
Yeah, because I had a horrible year in 2019 with allergies that I have had since I was a child. And last year was the worst that it's ever been in decades for me. So now, seasonal allergies, which have always been part of my history, I am looking at them with a bit of dread now. Because last year was uncomfortable, and you know, coronavirus or not, I am not looking forward to that either. But I will continue.
So it hasn't come on for you yet.
That's right. Knock on wood. As they say, you know, we will keep hanging in there, keep washing our hands, and keep scrubbing down the counters, and not shake hands, and maintain social distancing.
Covering your cough and your sneeze. Do you know how many people still do not do this very basic prevention measure?
There you go. I really appreciate your time, Dr. Lisa Fitzpatrick. I'm sure we'll be talking again. And I just want to say to you and to our listeners, please, everyone, stay safe. That is The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141 for this Wednesday, March 25th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.